Health Social Services Committee to order at 1:32 p.m. We have three people present, so we do have a quorum. We have Vice Chair Passfan, and we have Senator Dot Ellis present, and Betty Davis chair. We have one bill to come before us today, and it's Senate Bill 168. And there's a person that's going to be testifying on this bill that's really going to be working out of two committees because he's on judiciary, and that's Senator is going to go here and then go back over. But I also have my aide, Tom Overmeyer, who is able to help answer questions and have the package in front of him. But I'm going to call the two of them up. As you look at your package, you can see this is a committee bill. And it was submitted by request. And the person that requested the bill, when he talked to me about it, I was glad to do it and did make it a committee bill. Actually, they were introduced the same day, I think, and had the same number when Senator Coghill was then representing Coghill on the other side. And so because he has such a great interest in this bill, I'm going to give him the opportunity, and he carried that bill on the House side. And he's worked with the department and a whole lot of other people to bring this bill before. So we're going to hear from him first so that he may go to his judiciary meeting, and he'll come back if he has to.
Thank you, Senator, Madam Chairwoman. Senate Bill 168 is pretty simple in its workings. It is a fund that we're trying to put together that will have a direction to it. To create a fund, much like a piggy bank, and the reason to get into the piggy bank will be kind of devised by the department under the health care trauma issues to try to get the hospitals to raise the level of their trauma rating. So that's kind of the brief introduction to it. Madam Chairman, it comes from the College of Surgeons report that I read almost 2 years ago that shows that in Alaska, our trauma system is not as well coordinated as it could be, and we have hospitals that could raise the level of their rating. And I think I gave you a booklet that has this. If you could,
everyone have it.
Before we get to the sponsor statement that I wrote, if you could go to the tab 3, page 6 of tab 3, this is the reason I began this journey. And then I can explain to you what I hope this journey will result in. The Alaska trauma system, and I think Senator Ellis was a part of this, putting this together, put together a voluntary system of getting the hospitals involved in delivering trauma care. And up to this date, the voluntary system has done many things well, but there are things that we need to do better. And so if you'll look on page 6 on the right-hand side, you'll see under the trauma care system, the current status 16 years after we began the journey of putting in statute a trauma care system. We have 24 hospitals in Alaska. We have one level 2 trauma center, and that happens to be the Native Health Care Treatment Center in Anchorage. Which travels in a different system than the majority of Alaskans. Of those 24 hospitals in Alaska, we have four facilities that have the level 4, none of them in Anchorage. And so none of them in Fairbanks. And I think we can do better than that. And so this bill really creates a fund that is to incentivize moving in that direction. If we can get money into that fund that will give them a reason to get their uncompensated care taken care of and move up to a trauma level 3 or even 2, because I think there's two hospitals in Anchorage that could reach a level 2 if we gave them the right incentives. The Fairbanks Hospital could easily reach a level 3 if we give them the right incentives. And so the uncompensated care is one big portion of that. And hopefully we could turn some of those nine other facilities that are now under some review into a bona fide, nationally level certified trauma care center. Also, on if you look in tab 7, you'll see that you have the trauma system consultation from the American College of Surgeons. This is the report that I read that began my journey in looking through this. If you go to page 7 of that, under tab 7, page 7, you will see their recommendations, or their assessment, I'm sorry, Madam Chairwoman, of the challenges and vulnerabilities of trauma care in Alaska. So since I've begun looking at the challenges and vulnerabilities in Alaska, last year I introduced this bill. The first hearing happened on the House side when I was indeed a representative. And from that day until now, several things have happened. I have had two meetings where I've had stakeholders, hospitals, the Health and Social Services, the people who would be involved in this discussion. Out of that discussion came at least three good things that I would like to report to the committee before I make my further pitch. One of them was the Department of Health and Social Services has indeed seen the need and has made it a priority to better deal with trauma care in Alaska. Out of that meeting came the idea and from the recommendation that they needed somebody in that department who, when they wake up in the morning, what they think about is how can we do it better in Alaska. And I'm glad to report that they have hired such a person. What they did was they took one PCN, modified the authority and responsibility of that person, and now that person wakes up every morning thinking, how can we do trauma care delivery better in Alaska? So I think that's a good start, because if you'll look on here, the second bullet was no trauma system strategic plan has been developed. And now I can tell you from the time we started session till now, that person is getting up and that's what their whole life is going to be about. And so I'm very pleased with that. There are other things that will fall under that leadership, including the second bullet, which is the standards for trauma triage. But if you look all the way down to the bottom of those bullets, few incentives exist for hospitals to participate in the trauma system. And that's where this bill comes in, and that is to try to find a way to incentivize hospitals to participate. And I think we can do better. Let me just describe to you what I think I have found to be part of the problem. The hospitals have been doing a yeoman's job, so I am not going to pick on them, but I think they could do better. The doctors do a yeoman's job. They have private practices, and they have to work in the hospitals under call. They do a yeoman's job. They get very high credit from me. But because they are both doing their jobs very well, the collaboration between them, I think, has been not as good as it could be. And this bill, hopefully, will get them closer together, in my view, to help them establish a better relationship. They can then go down the road of saying, we can deliver consistent trauma level 3 or 2 care in Alaska. Madam Chairwoman, in Alaska, we have a very big volunteer base. We have a very big chunk of real estate we have to work in. There's a lot of people in Alaska who are first responders who do it because they are called to do it. They don't do it because they're getting paid to do it. They invest their whole lives in helping people get from the time of any tragedy to the time they can get to the hospital. And they are to be commended, and I would that we support them in any way we can, both in training and apparatus and encouragement. But if their work goes unappreciated at the entrance to the hospital because we do not have a good working relationship between the doctors and the hospitals, I think we have failed the people of Alaska. So I'm making a pitch. And I just will tell you one own personal story here. It was just over 2 years ago that my own grandson fell and had a brain trauma and got stabilized in Fairbanks, got medevaced and flown to Anchorage. It took from the time he fell to the time we saw a doc almost 7 hours. And that's just not good enough. Now, he died, and it was probably the saddest thing I had to deal with in my life. I don't blame anybody. Everybody was doing the best they could do. But you know what? It's just not good enough. We got to do better. And so this issue doesn't drive me with any, I don't have one iota of revenge, but it has certainly put a lot of tenacity in my willingness to push this issue forward. And I know that all of us are going to deal with tragedy in some time in our life, but if we can have a system that is well coordinated and at the highest level we can possibly push it in this state, I think we should. So the fund right now is just a fund. It's just a piggy bank. It doesn't have any money in it. And if we pass it out, it would just be a template. I'm asking us to send forward a fiscal note to the Finance Committee that says, let's put $5 million in. And the $5 million is a congruent number to other states who have similar populations but have a better trauma care system. So this takes care of uncompensated care in a reasonable and effective manner. And so from Louisiana to, I think it was, one of the Midwest states. I'm sorry, it's slipping my mind. But we looked at two other states with similar populations. We took their amount that they put into uncompensated care at the state appropriations level and made it congruent to what we're doing here. And $5 million came in to be about the number. I'm asking that we do that. There are several ways and methods I think we can get there. One of them is we have money that flows through Alaska that is Medicaid money called disproportionate share, and it is for uncompensated care, and it is given hospitals with a specific purpose of uncompensated care. And I think we can take a portion of that stream if we talk to our department and ask them to re-identify that in their Medicaid plan. That's an uphill battle, but I think that's one reasonable way to do it. In the other body, when I testified on this, they put forward an amendment that suggested we take a portion of the tobacco tax money or tobacco settlement money. I'm unclear as to what that was. But all they did was say, you could take some of this. Well, the fact is, it's general fund money anyway. And so we're not going to have dedicated money at this point. But I'm open to suggestion on how we might be able to fill that piggy bank. And then if you look at the bill at the very beginning here, I'll finish out my testimony with how I think we can move forward. This establishes the fund in Section 1, and then it says it designates that they shall be based on a nationally recognized standards and procedures for those who provide for certified trauma issues. I didn't state that very well. They will establish regulations that say, in order to get into this fund, you have to have reached some nationally recognized standards for trauma care. And at the highest level you can get there is what I'd hope they would go for. Madam Chairwoman, I am loath to give the department any more authority to make regulations, but I don't know of any other way to specifically ask them to do that. There is good news here in that the levels 1 through 4 are very well defined on national standards, and we have them outlined in our own statute. So I'm grateful for that. Also, the fund would consist of money appropriated by the legislature in Section 2B and 2C. It would be designated uncompensated care trauma money, and then they would do a review from those committees that already do trauma system review. So, and then the end is Part D of Section 2, what they may not provide more than 25% of the total assets, including earnings of the fund in the fiscal year. So it would be the idea of having a fund that was stable. And I'm open to suggestion on that, but that seemed to be the reasonable place to start. I gave you a lot of information in this. There, you're going to hear some testimony on the need in Alaska, and the need is there. We have such a wide range of issues. But let me just tell you on my own personal story. When my grandson fell, we didn't ask how much were we paying for the car. We didn't ask you know, what's it going to cost necessarily? We were willing to mortgage our house, do whatever we had to do to get that person the kind of help we could get them. And I think in Alaska, we could do better. And I think what we have to do is say, are we willing to put up enough to get our hospitals to raise this level? I would much rather go down the incentive road than in the directive road, because I think it's a better business model, and Alaska's healthcare world is a lot more fragile than some people think. And I think you know that very well, Madam Chairwoman. So with that, I will stand down to answer any questions if you would like.
Before we go any further, I'd like to recognize the other two members of the committee that have arrived. Senator Dyson came in, and we also now have Senator Thomas, so we now have the full committee. I guess the committee and the people that are present in the audience can understand why I had Senator Cahill to come forward, because he's really had spent a lot of time with this and has a lot of ideas that I thought you would want to hear, and you have some background on as to why he introduced the bill in the first place. We have the bill before you, which we will discuss, but we're going to hear from the department and anybody else that's going to testify on this bill. I know that Senator Coghill has another committee that he has to go to. If there are any questions that you want to ask him while he's present, I'll be willing to take those at this time. Ellis, Senator Ellis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. Senator, thank you for bringing the bill before us. Did you, or how would the fund distinguish between, or would it distinguish between for-profit healthcare facilities like Alaska Regional and the corporation they're under, and a nonprofit like the Sisters of Providence? Would there be, would it distinguish between those different kinds, for-profit or nonprofit operations?
We're leaving some of that up to the department, Senator, but it would be my expectation that no, they should not, because I think both of them have a place to play, and in my view, both of them could raise their level of designation. Because of the research I've done, I would think that Providence is most likely to reach the level two level of trauma care, and that the regional hospital could at least establish a level three fairly easily. There are economic considerations in that, because they're competing for the same customer. I understand that. So that's why I think incentive-based is best, but it would be my expectation that the different business models would not be in the way.
Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And thank you, Senator Coghill, for bringing this before us. I guess I'm a little bit concerned that there is that much lacking of level of care for an existing in the state of Alaska, and when we talk about creating a fund for it, it causes me to wonder not just why a fund is necessary totally, but the idea that is our trauma situations generally not covered by insurance? Is that the need? Is that why there creates such a great need for a fund?
Madam Chair, Senator Thomas, it's not that bad. We can just do better. So yes, insurance will pay, and yes, Medicaid does pay, but there is a lot of uncompensated care that is more primary care related, and I'm saying that we should at least first take a look at the uncompensated trauma care. To me, that would be a priority issue, and so part of the issue is the different business models. I'll give one example. The one that is a level two hospital in Anchorage is the Alaska Native Health Tribal Consortium, the hospital there. Their doctors are actually on staff. They pay their doctors. Where you take the other hospitals, whether they're nonprofit or for-profit, they have doctors that come in and do ER-related work on call, and they have private practices. And so their interest, naturally, is to keep their private practice healthy and do public service within the hospital under the emergency medical care. And so the working relationship has a natural tension, and I'm trying to relieve some of that tension so that trauma care docs are more on call than not. And I was hoping that this particular trauma fund would not only help them see that, but it would give the hospitals a designated dollar that says, if we do raise our level, we can count on this uncompensated care package. I think insurance would still be a huge part of it. In fact, probably a majority part of it. So and I'm not going to sit here and beat up hospitals, because they do, in many cases, what a trauma level 2 does do. They just don't do it on a regular and consistent basis. They can't put their shingle out, say they can do that because of the way the relationship is with the doctors. I'm telling you a little more than I know, but I know that's part of the discussion.
If I could. So it's more a problem of having the doctors available in some kind of continuity so that the hospital can be considered or advertised as a trauma center, more so than maybe even some of the payment, because I see no problem with them advertising, you know, and building all kinds of other centers around the hospital for various things that they do. And so I guess, okay, I'll read more of the booklet.
Senator Pat Graham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Coghill, I do thank you for bringing this bill before us, because I do think that the public has a natural thought connection between trauma and hospitals, and they believe that there is some trauma capacity when one does go to a hospital. You know, but then I also know that there is a contractual relationship between hospitals and emergency rooms, and what, you know, is, if, you know, how is this going to apply to that separate legal entity that is many times, you know, staffing the emergency room?
Yeah. Madam Chairman, Senator Pasquin, I don't know. But I think in the process of this discussion, we should draw that out. And there are probably that and a dozen other things that we need to keep drawing out to find out how can we do it better. And so those contractual relationships, though real, should not be barriers. Sorry, I wish I knew.
Continue the discussion. No further questions at this time.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, in your work on this issue, have you found that hospitals break out their uncompensated trauma care from other uncompensated care? When we've had conversations about health care reform or different initiatives over the many years, we've often talked about uncompensated care. And I've gotten the impression over the years that the Sisters of Providence and nonprofit hospitals feel more of a moral obligation. They don't turn people away, and they have more of an obligation to write off or pass on the costs to the paying customers, and they eat some of the uncompensated care in their budgets. And my impression has been that the for-profit health facilities do less of that, so to speak. They don't necessarily turn people away, but maybe they pass on more to the customers and eat less within their budgets of the uncompensated care. So that's the question. Do they distinguish between their uncompensated care, or would we be providing a fund that may or may not accrue to future trauma care?
Madam Chairman, Senator Ellis, I'm not an expert in that field, but I'll tell you what I think I understand, and then probably the department can finish it out and call me a liar if I'm wrong. But if the uncompensated care through the disproportionate share is a stream of money that comes in to hospitals when they bill Medicaid. And so whether profit or nonprofit, I think that flows probably fairly equally. Probably the biggest difference between the for-profit and the nonprofit is where the money ends up in investment, in my view, whether it's investment in profit centers or care that is turned back into the hospital facility, rather than to a board that has to disperse it to shareholders. So, but it's been my experience that in looking at both business models, both of them do make profits, and it's just a matter of what do they do with those profits. Some return in the communities, some don't. So I think, but as far as I know, the Medicaid dollar flows fairly equally to both models.
Senator Dyson?
Thank you. And Ellie, thank you, Senator Coghill for doing this, but I also apologize for having not read it all and come to this meeting really prepared. But this whole area of the billings or medical costs is something that's fascinated me for quite a while. And the uncompensated costs for both the profit and the so-called nonprofit ones often get cross-shifted to third-party payers and more, unfortunate term, but in essence, lucrative portions of the work of the business, and that produces real distortions that are unfortunate. It's my own observation that government has forced them to do that. Governor Murkowski started out here to try to fix that, and I think this trail he was going to go down was government's going to force you to take all these folks that come in the emergency room, then government's going to come up with a mechanism to pay you directly, pay the provider directly, instead of having them shift it to other really uninvolved third parties. And I'm sorry that it didn't get very far with that, but it seemed to me like a kind of a genius idea. And I'm a great fan of the hospitals in my community, including Providence and Alaska Regional. I haven't had much experience at ANS or the military hospitals, but Providence Hospital, there's lots of money that comes through there that lots of business would be called profit and doesn't stay in Alaska and flows out to other parts of what I think that Sisters of Providence do. So those get pretty, the definitions get a little confusing, I'm surprised that our hospitals aren't equipped to do a higher level of stuff, and if your bill will get them the incentives to get there, I'm really in favor of it. It happens to be our chief medical officer is here and has spent a good part of his professional life working on stuff like this in Alaska, and I'm going to be really interested to hear Dr. Hilbert's testimony on this. But anyways, thank you, John.
Senator, if I could just respond a little bit. First of all, I think the profit that hospitals make is due them, whatever the business model. I do not disparage them at all. So this is an incentive. I don't want to sound like I am talking negative about the hospitals. The fact is, in our state, we are not going to refuse people at the ER by law. And so we are going to have to figure out ways to do this. And Senator Ellis can probably laugh at me a little bit. I'm loath to spend any more money. And here I'm asking for $5 million to be drawn out of our regular budget to be designated to do a health care improvement in Alaska. So I feel uncomfortable already, but he can have fun with that later. and then, Madam Chairwoman, but I think that if we're going to take care of things in Alaska, then this system of approach to our citizens is a must. So I think the hospitals are not to be looked down upon, but we're looking for solutions to make it better. And that's what this is all about. This is one incentive-based. The recommendation, quite frankly, from the College of Surgeons was a mandate. But I just find that would be harder to get to and probably never gotten to in Alaska. So this is one incentive. And because of this bill, I told you at least one thing that happened, and that was the coordinator from the state. But there's a couple other things that happened that you probably need to be aware of. The hospitals have really gone on to alert on this issue and have begun a discussion. So that's, to me, good process issues. The other thing is they actually began talking with the military who have trauma docs who have to deal with docs in war zone issues. The question is, how do we work with the hospitals and work with the military? Can we work with our medical credentialing commission? And once they do work in the ER, how do you do a handoff? all those things can be done because the docs are qualified. The medical board said that they could work on it. And the fact is, right now, in both hospitals, they do locums. They have docs that come in from out of the state, and they do handoffs already. So I think all those things have been under discussion, and we're working our way through them.
Yes. Yes, Senator Ellis?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to speak again. And when I saw Senator Coghill's name associated with a $5 million price tag, I resolved in my heart not to rub his nose in it or call him a big spending liberal or anything like that. No, I sincerely appreciate the effort. Has someone told you, though, through the chair to Senator Coghill, that $5 million is the right? You know, we're always looking for the sweet spot, right? What is the amount that we need to give to incentivize good behavior or the right behavior in the state and not give away too much, whether it's oil taxes or whatever it might be? You've come to the conclusion that $5 million will get us what we're after?
And Madam Chair.
Could it be less, or will it have to be more in future years?
Madam Chair, Senator Ellis. It was, like I said, it was done in some congruency with other states on what they do in uncompensated trauma care with their own appropriations. So it was a ballpark figure. I can tell you the department is going to come in and have a neutral position because they're loath to spend any more money, and I can appreciate that. We're under huge downward pressure. And so I'm open to discussion. But I think that if we do less, we get less. And this seemed a reasonable amount based on those congruencies that I found.
Any further questions? If not, I'm going to, at this time, ask that the administration come forward. Dr. Holbert, will you come up? And anyone that's going to join you.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. For the record, my name is Ward Hurlburt. I'm the Chief Medical Officer with the Department of Health and Social Services and the Director of the Division of Public Health. As I mentioned when I discussed this issue yesterday, one of the first things I learned when I started my job last summer was how appreciative our folks have been of Senator Coghill's interest and passion and hard work that he's put into this area. One of the major responsibilities of the division has to do with prevention of unintentional injuries, handling those after they occur, and how do we prevent them. And so we do appreciate this. A little bit about my own background. I first started in Alaska as a physician in 1961 out in Kanakanak, out in Dillingham. And trauma has always been a big problem for us here in Alaska. Fortunately, it's better than it was back then. But I saw that from a field perspective. And then after I had my training as a general surgeon, spent many years at the Alaska Native Medical Center. And again, a big part of what I did was deal with victims of trauma. Part of it's our lifestyle here. In the rest of the country, they talk about hard rock mining as being the most dangerous occupation to have. And we have that in this state. There are not many commercial fishermen in many parts of the country. That's more dangerous than hard rock mining. And so, by the way, many of our citizens make their livelihood. That's a problem. If you're going from Nome to White Mountain, we don't have an interstate highway yet. So you have to ride a snow machine, and that's more dangerous than getting on a divided interstate highway. If you want to have fun, what do most of us do in Alaska? We go fishing, we go hunting, and what's a dream trip? Maybe to go to the North Slope and bring your snow machine to go hunting and do that. Those are all risky things to do. So it's a part of our lifestyle. It's a part of the way we make our living. It's a part of the environment that we live in. It's part of the way we have fun. And so we do see a lot of injuries. When I was with the Alaska Native Health Service here, very much involved over many years in planning for the new facility after that 1964 earthquake. Almost shook the ground out from under the old hospital down there on 3rd Avenue, and the engineers said it was seismically unsafe. took many years. Senator Stevens finally got us over the hump, and we got the new hospital there on Tudor Road. But when we did that, one of the things that was done as a part of the planning on that was recognizing the problem that unintentional injury and trauma plays in the lives of Alaska Natives whom we were dealing with, and made that facility one that met the standards that we would need to provide those kinds of care. For Alaskans, for all Alaskans, Native and non-Native, from birth through age 44, unintentional injury, trauma is the biggest killer. Overall, it's number three for the state. Cancer's first, cardiovascular disease is second. For Alaska Natives, it's number one overall for all ages. So it's a big problem. As Senator Coghill said, and the administration recognizes and appreciates the quality of care that's provided for the residents of Alaska by all of our healthcare facilities, the hospitals, the physicians, the many other disciplines around the state, and we do appreciate that. But we have learned in the administration through the Trauma Systems Review Committee, through the Alaska Council on Emergency Medical Services, we have learned the kinds of things Senator Coghill referred to about the trauma systems and the categorization of trauma systems. The American College of Surgeons has taken the lead, and they've done that because surgeons are usually the first profession specialty to deal with serious trauma victims. And they may need to call in neurosurgeons or orthopedists or urologists or many other specialties, but they're the ones to see the victim, to manage the patient overall. And so their professional organization was instrumental in developing this system. And this is the kind of a system that the rest of the country has adopted and accepted. This is the way we care for trauma. And it has resulted in improved results. The New England Journal of Medicine, a very respected and probably 200-year-old medical journal published in Boston there, has published an article that compared the outcomes, the mortality, for trauma victims between victims who got to certified facilities, who met the criteria for the level one, level two, level three, whatever, and those who did not. And there was about a 25% difference in the outcomes, a lower mortality rate for those trauma victims that were matched by severity of trauma that got to the certified facilities compared with those who have not. We've learned that Alaska is the only state in the country without a level one or a level two trauma center for most of the population. Now, in our lifetimes, we'll never have, maybe in our kids' lifetimes, we won't have a justifiable, reasonable need for a level one trauma center. The level one trauma center for Alaska is Harborview Hospital in Seattle. The level one trauma center for Montana, for Idaho, for Washington is Harborview in Seattle. And so that serves our need and is the reasonable thing to do for a level one. For level two, we're the only state then that does not have at least a level two trauma center for most of our citizens. Anchorage is the largest city in the United States without at least a level two trauma center to take care of trauma victims. So we're a little bit outside the norm in a way that we don't want to be, in the way that we don't like to be. Senator Coghill mentioned that we have, consistent with the recommendation of the report from the American College of Surgeons in 2008, we have hired a trauma systems coordinator, a woman by the name of Julie Rabeau. And I mention her name. She had been working with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium on their trauma work. Her background has been as a trauma nurse. She worked in Las Vegas, where, as you might imagine, their share of trauma and probably a little bit more, and had good experience. She has a lot of passion about it. Julie's an interesting person to hire. She just started in the job last week. Her mom was a nurse in Kotzebue. When her dad met her, who was a doc, he had started in Tanana. He was in Kotzebue. And he spent a number of years here in the state. She was born outside and didn't live here until she came to ANTHC. But her dad was also one of my predecessors. He was in this job with the state about 1980 or so. So she has strong Alaskan roots, a lot of passion about trauma, And we are just tickled pink to get her into that job to fulfill one of the recommendations that the American College of Surgeons made to us. We recognize that hospital participation in meeting the criteria is voluntary. We understand that the criteria are being used across the country. We also recognize that the standards need to be fulfilled, need to be met by both physicians and hospitals. It's not something that Providence or Fairbanks Memorial or Regional or any other hospital can do alone. It's something that the physicians and the hospitals need to agree to. For level two, your general surgeons need to be able to be in the emergency room when they're called in 20 minutes. For level three, 30 minutes is a standard. Level two also has a higher level, for example, of neurosurgical capability. In my mind, it would not make sense for Fairbanks Memorial to go for a level two, but it would make sense and would serve the citizens of that city and that region if they could go for a level three. If Regional were to go for a level two, I agree with Senator Cockhill that's reasonable for them to do. Probably would not meet the needs of Anchorage because they don't have the capacity. It's a smaller hospital, as we see on television all the time now. So that Providence, because of their size and because they do have certain capabilities there, is pretty key. And I think it would be reasonable to have Providence be a level two facility. The administration encourages healthcare systems and the physician community to embrace this, to seek certification. Providence actually did look at it several years ago, and at the time felt, for a number of reasons, including the lack of adequate support from the physicians to meeting those criteria, that they could not obtain it and did not pursue it further at that time. There's an interesting example for us, perhaps, in Tacoma, in Pierce County, in Washington State. A number of years ago, and for those of you who know Tacoma, there are several hospitals there. The two large ones are St. Joseph's, which is of the Franciscan hospital system, and Tacoma General, which is MultiCare. Now, they both happen to be nonprofit, but where I've worked in both kinds of systems, I would basically agree it really doesn't make any difference whether they're for-profit or nonprofit in what they need to do to be financially successful. But those two competing systems agreed together that they would be one trauma call system. And so the paramedics will take patients to one or the other depending on a schedule. As a physician, it sounded really hokey to me when it started, but it's lasted for quite a number of years now and it seems to work. Another interesting aspect on that is that Madigan, the military hospital there, at Fort Lewis, is a part of that. They don't take very often, they don't take civilian trauma victims to Madigan, but they participate, their physicians are involved in it. And when we look at Anchorage, and this is kind of the key, I think, for our state now is Anchorage. We have two competing hospitals, two different systems. We have a military hospital, and then in addition, we have the Alaska Native Medical Center that already has level two. But it's an interesting precedent to look at. So if they can do it in Tacoma, we ought to be able to in Anchorage. The position of the administration on this bill is neutral. There's clear recognition on the part of the governor, and the governor said when he met with the Alaska Council on Emergency Medical Services on Thursday, the day before Senator Cockhill was there, when they asked him about it, he said, this is something I can work with the legislature on. But the position is neutral, and the reason it's neutral relates to some of the concerns that Senator Cockhill expressed, that there is a preference to try to do this on a voluntary fashion rather than on a mandatory fashion. And the other reason is in a tight budget year, the $5 million that through Senate Bill 169 is associated with this because it has been a year of very tough choices. in making that. So for those two reasons, the administration's position is neutral, but there's full agreement as far as the reasons why this would be a good thing to do for Alaskans. Madam Chairwoman, I'd be happy to take any questions.
All right, thank you for your presentation. Anybody have any questions? Senator Thomas, we'll start with you.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Thank you for your testimony. Are there anticipated costs of what in the realm of human capital as well as resource capital for the two hospitals that we talked or you mentioned, Fairbanks Memorial to become a level three and Providence to become a level two?
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, there is concern that if you are designated as a trauma center, that somehow you will attract more individuals who do not have coverage through insurance, Medicare, Medicaid. So there's some concern that that could be a financial threat. Some of the things that the American College of Surgeons recommends, Providence, for example, already does. Like they participate in the trauma registry and they maintain that. There probably would be some additional cost to them, but the major specific concern that I've seen articulated, and I've read the testimony from last year on this bill from last April, has to do with potentially attracting more patients that do not have coverage.
You may continue.
So if that's the case, then it's not only a personnel problem, but it's an insurance. You know, the getting us to a whole different situation is whether we mandate insurance or move towards a greater affordability of insurance for individuals so that we can remove some of this issue, which is a profit issue, more than maybe a resource issue.
Through the chair, Senator Thomas. I think that is a major concern. I see a report each quarter of the 15 or 20 largest hospitals in the Northwest as far as their level of profitability. Providence, by size, does not meet so they're not in the report. The number two hospital in terms of profitability generally is Sacred Heart, which is a Providence hospital in Spokane. Number one is usually Children's Hospital. I understand that a Providence hospital here is the most profitable in a Providence system. I also understand that regional is a part of Hospital Corporation of America, and I don't see the numbers there, but is profitable for them. So they are solid financially, which we want them both to be. They need to be to be able to reinvest, but they do both return profits to their owners. But a part of managing any business, and I've been responsible for hospitals in both the for-profit and the non-profit private sectors as well as with the federal government. And the pressures are there, like in any business, to make your bottom line. The sisters are quoted as saying, no money, no mission. And I think Catholic hospitals often are very mission-oriented, but they also have to be very business-like. So I think they will naturally tend to protect any challenges to the level of profitability that they have, and that's normal. It's part of staying in business, I believe.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Senator Dyson?
I think you said this, and I missed it, but make sure. If we had a patient that needed a level one, level two stuff, will NS take them if they are not enrolled in the population?
Yes, thank you, Senator Dyson, through the chair. I didn't comment on that there. They do take some non-Native patients. The student who was stabbed recently at Service High School was being taken to Providence, and I don't know the reasons. My guess is it was probably because they were busy with other patients. But Providence basically told the paramedics, we can't handle her right now. Can you take her to the Alaska Native Medical Center, which they did. And so they take some non-Native patients there. They have the capacity. They meet the standards. But they only have 150 beds. And as the Native population has grown, and particularly as the Alaska Native population of the Anchorage area has grown, they're pretty much at capacity, so they cannot take a lot of non-native patients. They do take some.
Yeah, let me just close the loop here. But there's nothing in the federal regulations or laws that keep them from doing that.
Through the chair, no, sir.
How about with the military hospitals, Elmendorf, Fort Ridge?
Through the chair, I don't know the specifics of that system as well, but I think that any hospital could take a trauma victim. I know that Madigan has on occasion taken trauma victims. They are federal beneficiaries, but when I used to be the director of Las Vegas Medical Center, we worked very closely with Elmendorf. Changed a physician we might have a specialty they didn't, and vice versa. Okay. And occasionally a patient would go from one to the other. Those were not military families, although they were federal beneficiaries.
Thank you, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes. Senator Pasvan.
Thank you. You know, I'm listening to this conversation about general surgeons and whether it's 20 minutes or 30 minutes, but that assumes to me that there's some contractual relationship with the hospital on call where they would then be either there or available within that period of time. And that that assumes to or it infers to me that there is a transfer of care out of an emergency room into the hospital, you know, a discharge out of the emergency room and an admission into the hospital. Is that a correct or incorrect inference?
That's basically correct. Through the chair, Senator Pasquet, a level one trauma center will have folks in the house all the time. A level two will have anesthesiologists there. They need to be there for obstetrical care for other reasons, but a level two will not have general surgeons or orthopedists in the hospital. But what will happen in virtually any hospital is the trauma victim will go to the emergency room to be seen by the emergency room physician. They will triage the patient quickly, make their assessment, and then call in for a trauma victim, a general surgeon. If it's just an orthopedic injury, they might call an orthopedist in. And so that physician does come in. Generally, that physician will see the patient while they're still in the emergency room. If the patient's very stable, they may go to the ward. But generally for a serious injury, and that's what we're talking about, they will see the patient in the emergency room and assume the responsibility at that time from the emergency room physician. The point was made that ANMC physicians are salaried. Yes, they are, but when I was a surgeon there, I had my full-day operating room schedule, my clinics to do. It was a little easier because it was a very collegial situation, and I could, if I got tied up with a trauma victim, I could turn to one of my colleagues and say, can you pick up the ball that I'm dropping here? And they did, and it really was easier. But as far as having a day job, I did. I had the day job and needed to take the trauma call at night, and that was just a part of what we expected as part of being a surgeon.
You may continue.
Thank you. In other words, what I'm focusing upon, obviously, is it may be troubling to many members of the public if they don't understand their emergency room is qualified to handle trauma or their hospital is not qualified to handle trauma. And I want to be very careful about how we use that language and address that in the sense of what we really are talking about here is you have emergency room care that triages. Then while the paperwork may take time to catch up with it, there is a transfer of care from an ER doc to the general surgeon or the orthopedic surgeon then to address those specific issues, and it's the timeliness of that transfer of care that reduces the mortality rate of that we see in the difference between designated and non-designated hospital facilities.
Yes, through the chair, I may have passed over too quickly, but I did say, because I think it's absolutely critical to recognize that we in the state, same as Senator Cockle said, recognize and appreciate the quality of the medical facilities, the hospitals that we have throughout the state, specifically Providence and Regional when we're talking about Anchorage. They are high-quality facilities, have many dedicated physicians there, and we're fortunate to have them. So nothing that I've said is meant to imply otherwise. I would be happy with myself or my family going to either hospital, but we do know nationally when you meet those specific criteria, overall, looking at groups of people, your survival is significantly better if you meet the criteria for certification.
Yes.
I guess last question then, if I understand then this, how do you believe it's best to get that money where it's needed so that there can be the general surgeon on call or under contract so that they can be there within 30 minutes or 20 minutes or whatever your standard that you want to establish? What's the best way to put money towards that problem?
Through the chair, it may sound like a little bit of a cop-out, but I honestly don't know. The study in Tacoma looked at the different specialties by the experience of how often were they called in, and then tried to come up with a number that was fair compensation for that kind of call. So if you were a urologist and weren't called in very often, you didn't receive very much. If you were an orthopedist and were called more, you might receive more. There has grown in this country, in 2010, the world we live in, an expectation that you do receive money for being on call. My gray hair tells me that's a new concept, that it was part of being a doc, but that's the world we live in today. That's a part of it. Some hospitals hire physicians. You might hire and have a staff of general surgeons who that's what they do. Now there's concern on the part, there would be on the part of Providence administration, for example, if we do that, are we placing ourselves in competition with our own staff? And they need to be concerned about those. So it is complex, and I don't know for sure, but I think we do need to walk down this path.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Also mentioned in the booklet, of course, is the idea of prevention. And are there statistics that show that public education type programs really have an impact on it, or do we just continue to ride motorcycles without helmets and leave it to the legislature to try and force these things on people that they resent us doing anyhow?
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, yes, I think we have seen prevention pay off. The trauma mortality rates are lower than they were when I first came to Alaska, and we can go a lot faster on a snow machine now than we could on a dog team when I got here. There were no snow machines. It's hard to imagine now Alaska without snow machines. But prevention can mean lots of things. In this state, it's meant programs like Kids Don't Float. We have so much contact with the water, where villages are, where people live, where we do fishing, sports fishing, commercial fishing, subsistence fishing. Those kinds of programs have helped. They've reduced the amount of drowning that we have in some places. And it does really in our state. It involves getting your highway engineers involved because we know how, when you think about the road between Anchorage and Girdwood, we're still concerned because there's so many accidents there now. But it's a lot safer than it used to be, and all of us, I think, remember that. So it's road engineering. It's a lot of things, and I think we have demonstrated. The thing that Governor Parnell cites is, I've heard him say it several times, that when he was a kid, if somebody was in a party and they'd been drinking and they were intoxicated, you kind of didn't think it was your role to say, hey, don't drive that car. I'll drive you home, or let me call you a taxi. He said, that's the norm now. We kind of more expect that of each other. So I think that there's a whole host of things, and we have shown they can have a significant impact. And that's a part of why we have an injury prevention program that the legislature funds, so we can continue to work on that.
Thank you.
Any other question? Then thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I guess you will stay in case there's, after the public hearing, we might need you back.
Yes, ma'am, I will.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
We do have some people signed up for testimony, and we'd like to get to some of those before our time run out. So, Dr. Frank Psycho?
Hello?
Yes?
Yeah, this is Dr. Frank Psycho. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you. I will try not to, you know, repeat too much of what Ward and Senator Coghill so eloquently talked about. I'm a general surgeon. I work at the Alaska Native Medical Center, and I serve as the trauma director. I've been up here for over 20 years and have taken care of many injured patients. I'm talking to you actually in my role as the chair of the State Trauma Systems Review Committee. And what that committee is made up of doctors, nurses, pre-hospital folks, hospital administrators, and we meet twice a year, and we try and look at how we're doing as a trauma system and look at ways to improve. And we certainly appreciate the review that the state funded to have some outside experts who look at trauma systems all over the country come up here and look at how we're doing. I think when, you know, we talk about trauma systems, it's as soon as you hear any talk that has the word systems in it, I think most people's eyes start to glaze over. But it's important, and the reason we talk about it is, as Dr. Hurlburt pointed out, it makes a difference. Trauma systems kind of arose from the military experience, and I think we're all familiar with the model where somebody's injured today. It could be from an IED or a gunshot wound. And they get initial care. It's real important who's there with them and who's the pre-hospital folks. They get stabilized. They get moved. And there's a pre-planned response of where that patient's going to go. And that patient may go through several layers of care. They may end up getting definitive care back in this country. But everybody that touches those patients has got the right training. Each place they go is able to give the optimal care each step of the way. And that's really the basis for civilian trauma systems. And the federal government, and I think state governments all over the country have recognized this. And, you know, Alaska was part of many states that started down the road for developing a state trauma system in the early 90s when Lauren Lehman introduced the first bill. Alaska took an approach to make this completely voluntary. There was no incentive or disincentive, no carrot, no stick for the hospitals to participate. And we've gone 15 years since that legislation, and as has been pointed out, of the 24 acute care facilities, we really only have five hospitals that have been designated, and four of them are in the tribal system. And again, as Dr. Hurlburt pointed out, we really are. We're the only state without a level two trauma center that takes care of the majority of the folks that get injured. And, you know, for years, Arkansas lagged behind us, but we could always say thank God for Arkansas.
Yeah.
But Arkansas just funded their trauma system and has two level twos. They just spent $20 million. Georgia just spent $65 million. This not a red or a blue state issue. This is a bipartisan issue, like fire departments or ambulances. And I think the fact that we have Betty Davis and John Coghill both very committed to doing this is points out to the nature of the issue we're talking about today. I think there's a lot of details and a lot of questions about how this can be done. You know, I think it definitely can be done. There's 270 level two trauma centers around the country, and there are all kinds of hospitals there. There's only one native hospital. There's the rest of the hospitals that are level two around the country are community hospitals, some for-profit, some not-for-profit. There's a lot of different ways to get there. A lot of what we came up with as far as uncompensated care, as other people have pointed out, comes from other states' work. And since a lot of states are further down the road than us, we've had the opportunity to look at the way they've put their systems together. I think that, you know, this is the care that you want is for your injured family members. I think most of the public wants it. Most of the public's not aware, and surveys have been done. And if you talk to the public, 75% of them say this is the kind of care that they would want and would pay for. for their family. But when they checked on those folks, that 75%, most of them thought they already had it, even though the people they interviewed weren't in a trauma system. So the public is largely unaware of what is available to them. A lot of states have ended up waiting until there was a very high-profile incident where somebody didn't get the care they were supposed to and it got into the newspaper. And a lot of times that has been the incentive for going forward, as I'm sure you all are too aware of, that we tend to be reactive. But I again, would like to emphasize that this is a huge public health problem, that it affects almost everybody. It's hard for me to meet a patient's family up here that aren't in for an injury, but if you talk to them long enough, everybody's lives have been touched in Alaska by a family member or a close friend who's either died or had permanent disability. The level of care we're asking, the state is a big purchaser of health care, and you know, this is being a smart consumer. I think the way it's set up to have an incentive for the hospitals to participate is very good, but if this doesn't work, then we need to go ahead and we need a trauma system in this state. And I'd be glad to answer any questions, but I appreciate the time.
Thanks for your testimony. Any questions? Here are no questions. I'll call on Dr. Regina Chenault.
Yes, thank you. I am Regina Chenault. I'm a general surgeon in Anchorage. I am the state chair for the American College Alaska Committee on Trauma, and I also serve as the physician member on the Violent Crimes Compensation Board, and am also a member of the Alaska Trauma Systems Review Committee. I'm married and I have three kids, and I'm in the ER a lot because we're a busy Alaskan family. The fact that Alaska is the only state without a designated trauma hospital for the general public is a great concern for me. It's a public safety threat for everybody in Alaska, and it comes down to an ethical issue, I think, for us to allow this lower standard of trauma care to continue in our state. As mentioned, I work at the Native Hospital, which is a level 2, and our mission is to provide care to the Alaska Natives, and our beds are usually full, although we can care for non-beneficiary patients. I've had the pleasure since I came to Alaska in 2003 to provide surgical care in Alaska in several different places, including Soldotna, Kodiak, Ketchikan, and Anchorage, both in the private setting and here at the Native Hospital. And I can tell you that there are people dying that shouldn't be, and it's because these systems aren't in place. We have a lot of trauma in the state of Alaska. I see the domestic violence, the women and children that are being shot, beaten, raped, our law enforcement officers being shot. And I think that we really have to make sure that we get this trauma designation program in place so that Alaskans get the same standard of care that all the people in the other 49 states are already receiving. And I mentioned yesterday I testified on the House side, the same bill, that it's modeled after the pilot flight safety with airlines. An organized approach to trauma care makes us all have a 25% higher chance of living after an injury. And this is the reason we must pass this bill as soon as possible, because it is, I think, a huge ethical concern to allow Alaskans to continue not to receive the standard of care for trauma injuries. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? If there's no question, Senator Passman has a question for you.
I would just like to thank Dr. Chenault for allowing her son Jack to be the young page before the Senate last week, if you remember the young boy. So thank you,
Thank you very much. You have a thank you letter coming from him to be read, I guess, next session. He enjoyed it.
Thank you. David Hall? David Hall?
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Yes, very well.
Hi. Thank you for giving me time to speak. My name is David Hall. I live in Ketchikan, and I am the chair of the Governor's Alaska Council on Emergency Medical Services, or ACAMS, and I have permission of the council to speak on their behalf on this issue. I'm a fire chief for North Tongass Fire, just north of Ketchikan, and I'm a practicing paramedic with over 35 years of responding to all kinds of emergency calls for help. And those numbers seem to be increasing every year, especially trauma calls. I've seen injuries that I can still see when I close my eyes and exposed to the smells that stick with you for a lifetime. And this is kind of the arena that I approach this issue from. Trauma is any bodily injury from an external force. And trauma can be accidental or it can be intentional. And that is important, I believe, when you take into consideration the governor's stand on violence in the state. Trauma puts a tremendous burden on families and communities all across Alaska. An average of 400 Alaskans die each year from trauma. And for every death, 11 people are hospitalized. In 2004, there was a study that showed that the economic cost of a hospital stay alone for trauma patients in Alaska was estimated at over $73 million. One in four hospital admissions was uncompensated for, which puts an additional burden on the state's hospitals and healthcare system. Insurance does not cover all the costs, and for the most part, no one covers the costs of those without insurance unless they can afford it themselves. The trauma system is a predetermined, organized, multidisciplinary response to managing the care and treatment of severely injured people. A statewide trauma system also provides a framework for disaster preparedness and response. For a severely injured person, the time between an injury and receiving definitive care is the most important predictor of survival. More commonly known as the golden hour, some places in Alaska that could be the golden day or, depending on the weather, the golden week. The local EMS responders across the state have gotten pretty darn good at getting viable trauma patients to the hospitals. Then the hard work starts. Then it becomes the hospitals and the doctor's responsibility to keep up our good work. Increased hospital participation is necessary for the statewide trauma system to function optimally. The goal of a statewide trauma system is to see every hospital in Alaska become designated as a trauma center at an appropriate level. The ultimate goal of everyone involved, however, is to save lives. The Alaska Council on EMS, seeks your support for a fully functioning trauma system, including funding for the development of trauma centers and legislation addressing the issue of incentives for trauma care designation and uncompensated care of trauma patients. I would like to thank Senator Coghill and all the others for all their work on this bill and those who have contributed much to the debate. Please consider this request. Join our quest for a coordinated approach to trauma management. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? I'd like to call on Rod Beatty. Rod, are you there?
Yes, Madam Chair. This is Rod Beatty. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, very well.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rod Beatty, president of the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association. I think you have my written testimony in front of you. I wanted to just add that the hospitals in the state do support this legislation. We greatly appreciate Senator Coghill bringing it forward. He attended our annual meeting in Soldotna this year, and great dialogue took place in terms of some of the challenges that prevent hospitals from moving forward without legislation like this to help close the gap on the uncompensated care burden, but also around the availability of physicians. And I think you've heard it from others quite eloquently today that you have to be assured that physicians are in a hospital within certain time frames, and not just physicians, but certain specialties of physicians. And that's a pretty tall order for a hospital to be able to meet without clear understanding and agreement and collaboration with the physician community. Since the physicians are, in fact, independent practitioners, that's not something that's been able to be completely resolved as these discussions have taken place in the past. I think that we can get there, and I really believe the spirit of the hospital community is to want to get there. And as I point out in my written comments, if we could find a way to amend the language in this bill, particularly around the fund, so that as the department and the hospitals and the physicians sit down and try to understand the best way to make this happen, if other reimbursement barriers come up, be it physician-related or hospital-related, that the commissioner would have the discretion to use the fund to address those contingencies as well and not just limit it to the uncompensated care piece of this. That's important, but it's not the only thing that has gotten in the way. And I believe it was Dr. Hurlburt who said that when physicians are on call, whether they come to the hospital or not, clearly they do expect to be compensated for that, and that compensation varies depending upon the on the training and the frequency of the physician coming in. And that will be something that we'll have to deal with as we continue to try to work through this problem. I won't go beyond that other than say, again, we really appreciate Senator Coghill putting this forth and strongly support its passage and think it's the right step to take, particularly in an incentive-based approach where hopefully all of the key players can come together and figure out how we can get the higher designation in place in Alaska.
Thank you very much. Any questions of, yes, Senator Pasvan?
You know, I think that whether it's compensated care or uncompensated care, that trauma standards are important. And I guess my focus here is two questions and looking for your thoughts on it. For compensated care, what would be the position of the hospitals adding an additional charge or a rate with each admission that would require the compensated care payors to pay that additional charge? And then that's for the compensated care. And then for the uncompensated care, again, I appreciate the need for potentially a fund to pay for the uncompensated trauma portion of the staffing. Just what are your general thoughts on that?
Through the chair, Senator, it's typically done the way you just said, that when costs have to be recovered, either there's a arrangement made with a government entity, federal or state, to help offset those costs so they aren't then spread across the payers who are going in for services, or else it does appear on the payer's bill. And I think Senator Dyson spoke to that earlier in terms of the cost shift. So that's exactly what happens, and hopefully that would be minimized in terms of the amount that was not otherwise recoverable when somebody is seen. But clearly, trauma tends to carry with it a bigger portion of patients who don't have full coverage than regular health care does because of the nature of it. And again, the other piece of this, though, is costs that are not considered uncompensated care. They're costs that are for assuring the availability of specialty trained physicians to be in that hospital within the 20 or 30 minute window. Those would not show up in uncompensated care because it wouldn't be a patient for the most part to bill against, because a lot of time goes by where no one has to actually come in, but you still incur those costs. I hope I answered your question there.
Again, on the compensated care portion, it was not necessarily that the specific patient had to have received traumatic care. It's just that if the hospital had achieved a certain credential or a certain standard, that then the hospital would be eligible for a higher rate that the compensated care payer would be obligated to pay under an ordinary and reasonable standard. And then that way you diffuse the cost over both compensated and uncompensated.
To the chair, Senator, I think I understand better where you're going. I'm not sure I could speak to that. That gets into some reimbursement experience that I don't have. I'm not sure how the insurance rules would play with respect to that. So I probably ought not say yes or no on that particular scenario.
Thank you. Any other questions? Yes. Senator Coghill has the question.
Thanks, Rod, for testifying. First of all, the first question is, if you have language that you want to propose to amendment for this bill, I would sure be interested in seeing it. Then the other thing is, we've had discussions on what is going on in Congress with regard to trauma payment issues. Have you got anything that is worthy of us knowing at this point, or is it still pretty much in flux?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, it is pretty much in flux. In fact, everything seems to be up in the air at the moment based on what's been happening with federal health reform of late. And I do get daily updates on that, and I will certainly let you know as soon as I see any movement on that or any clarity in terms of where they're headed. Right now, it's not clear.
I'd like to speak to the request. This is not a committee bill for health and social services. If there is any amendments to be offered to you or to give them to my office, and we'll be glad to share that with Senator Coghill and staff to work on, but it's to come to my office as I chair that committee. So that's not just for you, but anyone that has any amendments. Anything that need to be submitted, need to be submitted to the committee. Thank you. Any other questions? Here are no other questions. I would like to call on Mark Johnson at this time.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. my name is Mark Johnson. I served as chief of EMS for the state for many years. Have a long history with this issue dating back about three decades. Currently live in Juneau. And took some notes, and I thought maybe I could help answer or maybe add a little bit to some of the questions that I heard. I was involved with then Representative Lehman in 92-93 when he got the initial legislation passed. It's currently on the books that provides for state certification of trauma centers using national standards. The standard we adopted was the standard of the American College of Surgeons, which I have in front of me. And that's currently in law, but as has been explained by others, it's a voluntary system. I also just briefly would add that a comprehensive trauma system, as defined by the College of Surgeons and others, does include injury prevention. In fact, a comprehensive trauma system plan covers all the way from injury prevention, pre-hospital care, hospital care, and rehabilitation. So when a comprehensive plan is developed for this state, presumably it'll have to address all of those components. And prevention, I think, is a good topic probably for another day, but we have made a lot of success on prevention in this state. There's more we can do, but the statistics show that there's been significant progress. There's also been significant progress throughout the EMS and I would say trauma system in Alaska. I've observed lots of progress. Dave Hall has identified some of that. Pre-hospital system is much better now than it was some years ago. And even the hospitals have done a lot. Every hospital in the state participates in the Alaska Statewide Trauma Registry, which Martha Moore behind me managed for many years and could answer any questions about. Trauma registry is required by the American College of Surgeons for documenting and reviewing trauma care and other types of information that also can be useful for injury prevention. Alaska has one of the most comprehensive trauma registries in the United States. There's been a lot of progress of training of hospital staffs. The College of Surgeons requires hospital trauma centers, the hospital staffs have to have, the nurses have to have trauma nurse training, physicians should have courses like advanced trauma life support. Those courses have been readily available in Alaska for many years. They continue to be available, and countless medical providers in this state have had that training. So there shouldn't be a major barrier. Some of these requirements, and I know that many hospitals in this state have a lot of people already trained. It does require a certain amount of equipment. To my knowledge, that equipment is available in virtually all of our facilities. It requires a process for continuing quality improvement, and that is using the data, looking at when you have bad outcomes, when you have complications, that there is a formal process for sitting down with the medical staff to look at what happened, what could we do different, how can we make it better. That is also happening in many of our facilities in Alaska. So I think there's a lot of good news. I think getting from where we are to where we want to be, there are some obstacles. Some of us have, you know, been dealing with these obstacles for a long time. One of them is, as I think has been pointed out, is that emergency departments are trained to do a certain level of care, but if the internal bleeding from the bleeding from the trauma is internal, then that usually means that you have to have a surgeon involved, and that's where you have to have somebody on call that's readily available, and that's kind of where our system is falling down right now. It's inconsistent. There are times when they are, there are times when they aren't. And when they aren't, that causes problems for the patient. So I think this is a good step in the right direction because this is an incentive. The College of Surgeons, when they came in and looked at our statewide system, and I think hopefully you all have a copy of this report, and their recommendation was every hospital in Alaska should be designated and certified at the appropriate level. The small rural hospitals, four of which have already achieved the level four status, so we know it can be done. If they can do it in Nome, if they can do it in Bethel, if they can do it in Sitka, there's no reason why all the rest of them can't do it. The mid-sized hospitals should be and can be a level three. And I think that because the legislation that was passed only was voluntary, as I think Dr. Sackle and others have pointed out, there's no incentive, there's no disincentive. You know, well, that's voluntary, but we don't get anything extra for it. And also to mention that in the 1990s, my office co-sponsored College of Surgeons reviews at eight different hospitals in this state, and I participated in some of those reviews, so I got firsthand knowledge of the process. Some of the hospitals came darn close to passing. At one time, Providence was very close to passing level two. Their biggest hang-up was the on-call schedule, as far as I can recall. And, you know, on this issue of uncompensated care, these testimonies are summaries, and reality is always more complicated than the summary. But some of the surgeons who have private practice, they have scheduled surgery, they know the insurance status of the patient before they do the surgery. If they're on call for an emergency and they get called in the middle of the night, they don't know whether that patient is insured or not insured, and roughly a quarter of them turn out not to be. So it's a disincentive, and hopefully this incentive will be enough encouragement for hospitals in cooperation for their on-call staff, because it'll maybe give them a little more. The hospitals may have to pay some of these people to be on call, and that may be the obstacle. I also think that there could be a little peer pressure. I think if a couple of our larger hospitals decide to do this, there'll be a little more pressure on the other facilities to step up and do it. And I would bet you that once they do it, a year or two later, they're going to look back and think, why didn't we do this a decade ago? Because I think ultimately it will make all their procedures so much more reliable, predictable. They won't have as many surprises. I just hope I
wrap up pretty much if you don't have another point that haven't been made.
Sure.
Because we almost about to run out of time, okay. I got a couple other people I'd like to
testify. All right.
And also, if they have a question of you, if you just stay until the meeting's over, they can see you then. Thank you for your testimony. Martha Moore?
My name is Martha Moore, and I'm here representing myself, and thank you for this opportunity to testify. I support this bill, and sort of for a selfish reason, because I'm a resident of Juneau. I'd like to see Bartlett Regional Hospital be a trauma center. I really think it could make the difference between life or death for me or for somebody else in this community. I feel that strongly about that. As Mark mentioned, I used to work in his office. I'm retired now from the state, and I worked with the trauma registry, and I also had many discussions with hospital staff about becoming trauma centers and all the issues regarding the trauma center. And I know that you've been given information on how trauma centers reduce mortality. And I think you are well aware that there are statistics both in the national and the statewide level that support that. And I just wanted to say a few things that just anecdotally from my experience working with hospital staffs and talking to people. I've had emergency nurses say that they didn't know what was coming in when a trauma would come in. They didn't know what to expect. Every hospital should know what's coming in and should be prepared for it and should have a helicopter or a jet on the runway. I mean, that's that's the kind of thing that really tightens up the timeline between getting someone to where they need to be. I've had paramedics say, you know, taking someone to a trauma center is a whole different feel to them because of the trauma team that's ready to take that patient. I've talked to staff at the hospital that have said, you know, since we became a trauma center, our anxiety level about taking care of trauma is really way down because we all know the standards, the protocols, we practice them, we know everything we're supposed to do, and we feel just a lot more comfortable about taking trauma. And I just wanted to say that I know there's been a lot of discussion about the larger hospitals in Anchorage. I think for every hospital in the state, putting the effort into being a trauma center could really make a big difference and improve the level of care for all Alaskans. And so I really support this bill just because I think this incentive is just the thing that might make it possible for these hospitals to achieve that.
Thank you very much for your testimony. There's only two other people. If my committee could just hold for that, I'd like to call on those two. The sworn Threadgill.
Hi, this is Soren Threadgill. Thank you for the opportunity to talk. I retired last month from the Anchorage Fire Department, where I was served as a paramedic and the chief of EMS operations. I'm a member of ACAMIS, and I'm also the chair of the Red Cross Disaster Consortium for the state. I do support this bill. Just quite simply, I just think just because it's going to improve the Alaska's trauma care, thereby, of course, improving patients' outcome. I do think it's one of the responsibilities of government to basically take care of its people. And in particular, in this case, where the people aren't always cognizant of the different levels of trauma certifications, basically they don't always know the difference between a trauma 1 or a trauma 4. But as stated earlier, Alaska's the last of the certified designations for trauma centers. We're at the bottom. So that's why I think this bill should pass. EMS started in the 60s, and it started from NHTSA because they called it America's epidemic, and it was due to all the trauma, the highway trauma. And there's a fair amount that EMS can do to stabilize trauma on scene, but the definitive care is at the hospitals, and specifically in the ORs of the hospitals, and that's why where the attention needs to go. The ACS review that I hope that you have in front of you, that when it came up November of 2008, it really does stress or emphasize the importance of collaboration amongst EMS, the hospitals, law enforcement, first responders, dispatchers, to educate the public in the different trauma cares, the specialists, the communication companies, the medevac companies, all the way down to the car companies. And if this type of collaborative, inclusive system is followed as recommended by ACS, we really will do wonders for improving Alaska's trauma care. If there's any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Thanks for your testimony. Any questions? Mary, I'm not sure how to pronounce your last name. I probably will mess it up. Is there a Mary there? She's muted?
No, she's unmuted.
Oh, but we have completed our list. And if there's no one in the audience, is there anybody else in the audience that plan to testify? If not, we'll close public testimony for the time being. We might have to open it up at a later time, but that will complete for today. And the only thing that I want to say to the committee, you have a lot of information in front of you. We looked at just the bill itself, 168. There was an appropriation bill in there for 169 for the $5 million. But as you can see, you also have three fiscal notes that's in there. The department said that they could not write, they had to give a zero. Yeah, they gave a zero fiscal note. We have that. And I requested that to come from the committee. But we still have that appropriation bill. I guess at some time when we get ready to discuss the bill, we'll decide which direction that we want to go in. and talk about what funding might be able to come from. But we did receive one also from revenue, and they gave it a zero. But that 169 is still alive, and if you feel that's the way we need to go, you know, eventually that's what will end up in finance, because we could send all the notes up there. But that one is still alive if we decide to go that way. I thank you for your attention, and we will adjourn at this time. And we're going to try to bring this bill back very soon so that we can get some movement on it and try to get it over to the next body. So thank you very much, and we'll adjourn at this time.